Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Thank you again, Brian Brown, for a wonderful introduction to Tuesday, August 11th, 2020. We are still in the year of the tweet. We are still in the global pandemic. And this wouldn't be progressive radio if I didn't remind you that today there are just 84 days left before the most important election in most of our lifetimes. If you're not finding opportunities to contribute to the outcome that you want in November, please email kevin@indivisiblevachon.org and we can help you. All right. So welcome, everybody. Glad you could join us today in the Gene Bosch studio in the relative calm and security of downtown Vachon. We find mood modulating synthesizer of voices from the virtual land of Zoom, complete with sound effects. Who needs autopilot airline and sound engineer? Truman O'Brien. Most folks may not know that you are also now our new Zoomologist. So yes. Thanks, True, for Zooming us all together again.
Thank you. And I was a little behind on my sound effects. I was struggling here, guys. I almost got them.
I was in a slow sort of leaning.
I know. I appreciate that. I appreciate that. Sentence, but, I was reaching for the button and I hit the button, but I didn't hit the other button. And oh my gosh, here we are. But
okay. Well, we got the buttons all lined up now.
There we are. Yep, we got it.
I'm glad that didn't happen when you were in the cockpit.
Well, it never did. No. I was snoozing. Oh, and I mean, I was always paying attention when I was flying.
Yes. Well, yeah. You have a co-pilot, you know.
Indeed. That's what they're for.
Right. Exactly. Hey, and next, let's recognize the increasingly perceptive and accurate vision of Lynn Kerrigan, poet par excellence, relocated from the land of magnolias to the island of Madrones, our analytic academic social worker, backup singer, activist, and former all-star shortstop for the Dixie Debutantes. Lynn, we see you're helping us see better all the time. How's recovery from eye surgery looking from your perspective?
Look at this, new glasses.
Whoa.
So I can see, I can read. So I'm going to call this back to normal. We can stop referring to my sad vision journey and move forward. All seems well. And Island Optical did a good job after all, though, boy, the delays for getting this were long, 2 weeks longer than expected. So things are still messed up in the supply chain. And, you know, we're kind of lucky out here on Vachon. We can ignore what goes on the mainland a lot of the time. And, you know, makes me think sometime the world is going to burn down and we wouldn't know it for a long time.
We'd miss
it. The smoke on the horizon.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, fortunately, for the modern miracles of science and medicine. So if anybody doubts science, which so many people are doubting science these days, just think about that next time you take an aspirin or any other kind of thing. So let's see. Also beaming in through the magic of network communications, perhaps from a recent visit to another galaxy, is island historian, storyteller, international educator, and accomplished skipper Bruce Hallman, our stalwart guardian of the galaxy. Bruce, how are you today?
Very good. Always good to be here.
Fantastic. Glad to have you on board, so to speak. And we'll be relying on your historical perspective as we wade into the week's happenings. Another sight, a very welcome sight on our Zoom screens and music to our ears, is master singer, thespian, half a bubble shy of Plum Carpenter, Michael Shook, a.k.a. Chauncey Gardner. Michael, are your new maple trees showing any early sign of the colorful display you're expecting to see this fall?
Only one, and not one of my Japanese maples. The one that's called Frank's Red, but there's just a little hint of color starting to go in that one.
Tell that guy to knock it off. We're not ready for fall yet.
It isn't nearly. You know, I'll go talk to it this afternoon.
Please,
you might
please.
Not be surprised. Know that I actually do speak to all the plants as I'm wandering around. I shake their leaves and pull on their branches and tell them what, you know, I just talk to them. So,
Well, it's not just cold weather. It can also be hydration can cause those changes.
So
the end of summer isn't necessarily here.
Okay.
Susan McCabe is also here, master of dialogue, political activist, part-time court observer, observer also of truth, arbiter of insight, and host of the important and discerning conversations that we all really need to hear on Real Talk. Susan, what's up on Real Talk this afternoon?
Orcas. I don't know if that's political. I think it is. Of course, everything is political now, but yeah. Mr. Garrett from the Orca Network, this is an encore. I spoke with him a few months ago, but it's a really interesting conversation about our southern resident orcas who are facing extinction and why and how and the choices that they make within their culture that have contributed to their dire situation. It's a very interesting conversation at noon.
Well, may I just say, Susan, that I am really looking forward to J35 having a successful pregnancy this time. I don't believe I could stand another 17 days of a dead orca baby carried around on the mother's head. That was the most profound display of grief I think I have ever seen.
And a message to us all from her. Thank you for bringing that up, Lynn, because, yeah, we're hoping for the best. And maybe it's a good sign that they're starting to make a comeback, though I think that would take a long time.
There was something that gave me a fair bit of hope. I read last week's paper. You guys may have seen it as well. And darn it, I can't remember which tribes it was, but up on the Nooksack River, now removed, or in the process of removing the second dam. They're small dams, but they were nonetheless quite effective in blocking salmon migration. And with those going out, they're talking about each one has successfully opened, or will when the second one's out, about 60 miles worth of extended river, and of course the all important tributary streams that go off of there for salmon spawning. And that used to be a really healthy Chinook run there. So, you know, it's one bucket full of water, but it still, it's a positive thing to me.
Right. Yeah,
we have to hand it to the tribes.
One of the things Howard Garrett says is that surprised me is that our southern resident orcas will only eat Chinook salmon. They will not eat other salmon, which is why they are faltering.
Yeah.
I don't blame them. I bought some chum salmon by mistake when I couldn't see and thought, what the heck is this mushy stuff? So I'm with them, just the Chinooks.
I am glad to see our southern residents have discerning tastes, as we all do on Vashon as well. So I'm glad they're part of our community. Hey, lastly, if you haven't figured it out from the voice of Vashon Brown Briefly scorecard yet, I am Kevin Jones, Indivisible Vashon's weekly publication for your consideration editor, finding way too many opportunities to stay busy. But I will say that I was happy to mail another 100 postcards off to both Iowa and Florida voters. We're asking them to sign up to vote by mail so they can vote safely. And we're also, of course, asking that the post office be funded. So lots of things going on within our work.
Well, looks like Florida has the president's approval to vote by mail where no one else does. Interesting.
the wonders of the universe may never cease. Susan, you had a comment.
Well, yeah, even though we are asking for the post office to be funded, Mr. DeJoy, or lack thereof, has already cut back on services, as I've noticed in our mail delivery, and they have noticed nationwide. So even if we manage to get the post office funded at its previous state, it's already being crippled by Mr. Trump's appointee.
And this speaks to this speaks just to the larger issue of, to me, of the complete moral and ethical bankruptcy of the Republican Party now. I know that there are Republicans out there who are conservative in the Edmund Burke sense, and those people I respect. Some of them are my friends. I know that there are many Republicans of that stripe who are deeply dismayed about the way the party has been taken over. But at this stage, I can't condemn just Trump. The rest of the Republican Senate, the sycophants who surround Trump, who seek to make money off of all of this, they're like a bunch of jackals. They obviously don't care about the nation. They obviously don't care about our democratic institutions. And their actions are deplorable, and they themselves should bring nothing but scorn upon themselves. It's time to throw them out. Just get rid of them.
I agree, Michael. And the other thing that I would say is that I think that the Republican attempt to privatize everything, which seems to be their main goal in letting governmental institutions fall, it seems so short-sighted and odd to me. Sort of similar to the discussion we're having now about defunding the police. So what do they think? If we privatize everything, there's no more need for government ever to do any kind of oversight or regulation. It just seems like a bunch of kleptocrats right now struggling to get everything they can.
Mm-hmm.
And their current attempts at voter suppression are blatant, and those are in our face. Those are there right now, along with allowing the Postal Service to be diminished. There, as we all know, they're gerrymandering around the country. They're putting in goons to be, quote, poll watchers. They are looking for, and wasn't the Voting Rights Act gutted by their Supreme Court so that gerrymandering is free and rampant at along with all kinds of restrictive voting requirements nationwide. This is they are trying to press vote, and they're succeeding.
That's nothing new. I mean, it's gone on for our whole political history. It's more evident now than it has been in the past because of the internet, because of communications, sophisticated communications. But, you know, if you lived in the South in the 1950s or the 1930s or the 1890s, exactly the same thing went on. It's interesting to me to sort of hear the partisan sort of dialogue going on both sides, because it sort of leaves no place in the middle for the compromises that are necessary in a democratic society. We've got some people who have very questionable morals and very questionable sort of goals in power right now, but we've had that in the past. What strikes me about this point right now is this is a culmination of 40 years of conservative attempts to sort of redefine the role of government. I mean, it started, and it goes back into the 1920s and 1930s and into the mid 19th century. So it's nothing new. But what we're seeing is that they have a control of power that very few have had in the past. And so it is a real threat, but it's not a threat that we haven't confronted before.
I think to me, the thing that's disturbing a little bit about the frame of that conversation, Bruce, is that it leaves open to interpretation whether what you're meaning is that it's happened before, it will happen again, so what? And I know that's not what you mean. I know that what you mean is let us learn from the lessons of history about how cyclical some of these episodes in our democracy are, and that it requires vigilance all the time and a willingness to discuss and identify ethical issues and corruption. And on Bruce, this morning on NPR, I woke up to a discussion about the periods of corruption that we're in now that is exactly as you said, you know, since the 1980s is what they said. And they said it was as big as the corruption that happened in the 1870s up through the 1890s when the conditions were much the same. Mm-hmm. Robber barons and all of these oligarchs were controlling most of the money that was being done by the labor of others. And we're kind of back to that income disparity split and a cry from labor and the rest of the country to be included in the benefits of our country.
Well, it's intriguing that this list is so long, and I'm going to actually add a couple of more things to it because last week we had preparations to talk about Attorney General Barr and his appearance before Congress. We also know that Barr is investigating the response to Russian interference in the 2016 election and has clarified that he will announce the results of the investigation before the election, which should not surprise any of us, but certainly Obama administration members could be named. Also, there's the focus on getting Kanye West on the presidential ballot multiple other states to, you know, drain votes, particularly from the African-American community who might be persuaded to vote for Kanye instead of Biden. So I guess the question I have, we see all of these happening, and Bruce, you have great historical perspective here. Generally, what do we think? How much do you think all this will really matter of all those things that are happening? You know, are these the things that are going to make the difference, or are these just the noise on signal? And it's just really the propensity of the voters that's really going to shine through. What do we think?
Well, from my perspective, it's noise. I mean, it's intensified because of the partisanship that's dividing us right now. But, you know, lead up to every presidential election involves a whole range of background noise, if you will. You know, issues and non-issues. And again, my perspective is it's intensified because of the nature of mass communications and the way it has evolved in particularly the last 10 or 15 years. And, you know, it's like the introduction of any, we talked about this before, the introduction of any new media technology, whether it's printing press, whether it's radio, whether it's newspapers, whether it's television, it takes a society time to adjust and redefine what are the sort of rules of the new media. We're at that right now with mass media and sort of social media. And we're struggling to define what that means, whether or not we'll be successful and whether or not it'll have an impact on this election. I don't think it will on this election. I think we're in a free-for-all. And it's very important that we recognize that for most of us who are living today, this is probably the most important election we will have in our lifetimes.
Amen, brother. And I would leap in to say that I think my concern about the media changes have to do with the loss of independent free press and free community-based, like our show, community radio, where it's not controlled by corporate sponsors and it's not controlled by, you know, a board of directors telling us what to say and how to say it. I think that the move toward corporate broadcast journalism and corporate ownership of news media concentrates the perspectives in the hands of a few. And it makes people have to be even more vigilant about how they are consuming their news or their information so that they can begin to think about truth versus beliefs.
Mm-hmm. Susan, you had a comment.
I do, because I think about, when I think about our current social media and the fact that we're in a pandemic, I'm really concerned about how the presidential campaign can be conducted and how that's going to affect voter turnout. And I wonder, Kevin, if you have some insight as to how the Democrats plan to conduct a campaign via social media, including a convention done by social media.
Well, it's interesting that you ask because, of course, so many groups, excuse me, have had plans to door knocking, talking to neighbors, and of course all the standards of phone calling and everything. Stay home, stay safe hit, and all of a sudden these Zoom meetings just blossomed into existence. But you know, a lot of the Zoom meetings were not making phone calls and so on. They were just checking in, how were we doing, right? Like there was this gap that we're trying to fill in our own personal space. But now what I see is more and more of that is shifting. And even the content of those, let's just check in because we're a group and we should be talking to each other. Now more and more of it I hear is, how are we going to work together in this environment? And other than the door-to-door interaction with voters, every other tool is still at our disposal. And in fact, it's opened opportunities because while it's really hard to go and knock on doors, say in Maine, it's really easy to write a postcard or make a phone call to Maine. So I see that people are perhaps given more opportunities now in terms of interacting and shaping the election. So, you know, one of the things that comes to mind also, you know, we have this long list and, you know, certain things we can do something about. I know, Lynn, you and I were exchanging information about all the media frenzy around what if Trump doesn't leave office. And that's one side of a coin, which is disturbing and frustrating and so on. And another side of the coin, maybe, and maybe it's a 10-sided coin, but another side of the coin is, you know, when public pressure mounts to a high enough degree, we've seen him back off of some of these things. So in one sense, the media frenzy may indeed prompt enough public outcry. Just kind of curious what we think the things we can do, given the threats we have, and how should we react and respond to them? Right. Michael, you have a comment.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because this kind of ties in with some things that have been going on in Lebanon right now, and with the whole Arab Spring. I remember when the whole Arab Spring thing came about. And you can go back even farther to the collapse and the implosion of the Soviet Union and some of the satellite states and everything. And this does tie in. I think it kind of gives hope. And because when people have their backs pressed to the wall for so long, and they have their voting rights denied for so long, and they have no opportunity to try to make a living economically, they have no opportunity to, which means they don't have an opportunity to raise their families or you know, live somewhere in a decent home. When people's backs are squished up like that so hard, eventually it'll break forth. If Trump, I think, were to, let's just say hypothetically, which is terrible, but let's do it anyway. He decides, it's a rigged election. We can't get all the votes counted in time, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to stay in office to manage things until all this is straightened out. I think probably much sooner rather than later, people would just say, no, that's not going to work. And I think we'd see massive demonstrations. I think we'd see people demanding remedies of some kind. And that's kind of what we're starting to see now with all the pressure from the pandemic and the pressure from the economics of it and the economic struggles that so many people have had. A lot of that is coming out now. I think that's why we're seeing so many demonstrations that just keep rolling along. At some moment, people just can't take it anymore. So, well,
it's important to step back and put this moment in perspective. I mean, pandemics create, you know, sort of seismic cultural and social changes. Every pandemic that has swept through, whether it's the pandemics that swept through Native Americans in the 14th through the 19th century, changed Native American society. The Black Death, I mean, you know, the list goes on. But they bring about fundamental changes in society. And so we're in the middle of it. It's hard to see where it's going to go. But already you see corporations having to modify how they treat workers because they can't get them. And if they can get them, they can't get them to work in locations where they have been very successful making money in the past. Meatpacking plants, they don't work like they used to work. And so what you're seeing is fundamental changes. And I think it's going to rebalance, the sort of power between corporate and workers in America. It's going to rebalance the way our political system works. And it's going to be messy. And, you know, we could be involved in a sort of modern civil war, if you want, whether it'll be a shooting civil war, whether it'll be, you know, in the streets kind of activism civil war. But it's the kind of thing where you need to ask yourself, are you willing to pick up a gun and go fight if you need to?
So, Bruce, I'm kind of curious about, you know, this timeline that we're talking about, because we're all like on pins and needles and we're anxious and an election's coming up in 3 months, et cetera. But we also know that this pandemic, it's like only, I think, 10% of the U.S. population has actually encountered the virus. And it's been, what, half a year now? So if you think about, they had to get to, what, 70% of community infection before you got to herd immunity. So that's seven times longer than what we have. That's like a 3 to 4 year period. Where do you think we are on that trajectory of getting through this pandemic and some of those changes emerging? Do we still have, is like another couple of months ahead of us? Is it a couple of years? What do you think?
My perspective is we're going to have a vaccine, you know, by the early next year. But 30 to 35% of the population won't take it, so you're really looking at, even if we have a vaccine, say by January, have enough, sort of doses to not only dose the American population, but the world population, it's going to take another 6 to 18 months. So I think we're going to be in the kind of situation we're in right now, well into the spring of next year. And what you're seeing right now is this virus accelerates. It moves to wherever its hosts are available. And you've already seen in the United States, mass meetings, people coming out for protest, not wearing masks, not Black Lives Matter protests, but, religious protests, and I'm not going to wear a mask protests. And young people, colleges, some colleges are going to open up this fall. You get 20,000, 18 to 22 year olds in dorms together. I think this fall we're going to see a disaster. That's my own perspective. And it's going to be well into next year before there's enough vaccines to really make a difference. That's my own perspective.
So not to change gears, but speaking of disasters, what happens in October if Barr brings an indictment against Biden for alleged illegalities that occurred during the Obama administration? What happens then?
Wow.
I mean, it's possible, is it not?
What happened when Stormy Daniels brought an indictment against Trump?
Yeah, well, nothing, but...
Yeah, but, exactly. Yeah. The American people have become immune to that kind of sensationalism, I think.
And that was the point I was trying to make earlier. It wasn't so much that we don't discuss these kinds of things. It had to do with my concern that the media sometimes thrives on sensationalism and fear-based mongering to kind of get people to read, their headlines, if nothing else. And I think that what Bruce is saying is really, really important, that we need to focus on kind of what's important to us instead of all this noise, to really focus on getting the votes out, helping people stay hopeful and not sunk or paralyzed or fearful by all of the things that could happen. I think for me, it comes from being a social worker in crisis settings all my life. I learned at Harborview that I could not focus on the dilemmas all around me all the time, or I couldn't function. I had to really keep my nose focused on what was directly ahead of me. That whole think globally, act locally is part of that. You know, when the world is too much with us and we think, well, why even bother? Why would my vote count at all in the middle of this craziness? It matters because we need to have a voice in a democracy. And regardless of the outcome, it's important that we show up and express our opinions. And to me, that is what's important.
Susan.
This may be way off track, but I hear us talking about this and I'm watching the incredible polarization of our country politically that has gone on for years and just amplified the Trump administration. What do you guys think of the possibility?
Wait, whoa, you just blocked.
We lost you, Susan.
We lost you for a minute, Susan. Oh,
repeat your question.
My question, am I with you now?
Yeah, we are. We hear you.
My question is, what do you guys think of the possibility after the November election of fomenting a third or fourth party so that some action can be taken, so that some of this polarization is mitigated and other views are allowed so that some action can be taken?
Are we talking the Kanye West party?
I thought that, Truman, but I decided not to say it.
I know.
I personally think the Republican Party is dead. The old Republican Party, it'll become the Trump Party and it'll become a minority party. And hopefully, you know, true sort of Edmund Burke conservatives, in Michael's terms, will emerge and develop a new Republican Party or a new sort of middle of the road conservative party that can work with middle of the road Democrats. And then what you'll have is essentially a four-party system or a three-party system with an extreme right-wing party, the Trump Party. You'll have an extreme left-wing party who knows who's going to lead that. But you'll have a party in the middle, either defined by two entities or a single entity. So that's what I think is going to happen.
You know what I think is fascinating about that? Because you watch it in Ireland and England and those with parliamentary systems, they have to form coalitions to be able to govern. You know, that one party may not have everything that's needed, and it kind of forces the system to include viewpoints that might not otherwise in a two-party system, you know, be heard at all. And I think that's fascinating. I don't know, you know, how we do it. My personal priority would be to get rid of the Electoral College the minute we get a Democrat back in office. So it goes back to what is the most important thing for us to do if we are able to take power again and, you know, have to steer the ship of state off the, you know, the shallow rocks that we're in right now.
I was just thinking, Lynn, I read a commentary just recently that the Electoral College system indeed really reinforces a two-party system, and that the framers of the Constitution didn't really focus on parties because they didn't think it would be all really that relevant or valuable. But very shortly after the new government, like within two or three years, parties were a thing and very dominant in terms of their ability to succeed. So. Bruce, you're nodding your head. It seems like, is that your perspective as well? The two parties sort of embedded in our Constitution?
Yeah, that emerged early. I mean, the sort of Washington Adams side and the Jefferson sort of side. And that has sort of perpetuated itself in American politics. And it's just the way the Constitution's framed, it sort of it enhances that ability for two parties to dominate and for third parties to struggle to have a voice. And that's where, I mean, we can't abolish the Electoral College without a constitutional convention. Constitutional convention opens up all the rest of the Constitution. So I think we have to find ways to to sort of mitigate the impact of the Electoral College and the sort of states agreement that's going on in progress right now is one way to do that. I think the two-party system has become detrimental to American democracy.
So Bruce, though, you were just talking about this coalition or whatever it is that's happening among the states, mm-hmm. where they're the change that they're bringing about to the Electoral College. Mm-hmm. Isn't that one way that it can be accomplished without having a constitutional convention?
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. And so if that's what people want, then that's the way it should be done, I would think.
Say that again. What's the alternative, Truman?
Well, right now, Bruce, you can say what the name of it is. I can't remember the name of the legislation. I know you're going to be blank, too. Doc got it.
But National Popular Voting Compact.
Is that it?
Yeah. National what?
National Popular Vote. And
Popular Vote Interstate Compact.
Right. It's where where each state votes that their delegates have to vote to what the majority of the country votes, not their state, but just the majority. So it basically eliminates the Electoral College.
Yeah, and I love the idea that parliamentary systems and the fact that parties need to form coalitions. I think our coalition forming is left to the parties to see who they can bring under their umbrella. But I do think that, somebody pointed out also, I can't remember where I read in 20 years, we'll look back at the party system we had and who's aligned with which parties. It's like they claimed you wouldn't know. It'll be unrecognizable what 20 years from now looks like relative to our current alignment of coalitions.
Mm-hmm. Can't happen soon enough.
Well, that's a good point.
That's, I suppose, the good thing about the pickle that we're in right now. There's a lot of things that can and will be upended.
So there's only
and
one way
we're
to
in
go.
A time that we can't control a lot of that. And it, I think, makes it harder for us to try to stay rational and to try to stay focused on, the bits we can do to encourage voting and to encourage hope. That's my goal, that people don't lose hope.
And I think Susan has a comment.
Yeah, well, this brings me to what brought me great joy last week was the New York Attorney General's call to dissolve the NRA, which not only is an organization that has done a whole lot of damage with its people, but even if they don't dissolve the NRA, it's going to keep them busy enough litigating so that they can't really give the kind of financial support to Trump that they gave in the last election, which I believe was $50 million they donated to his campaign. Is that right, Kevin?
Well, I know it was a huge amount of money, and I know this is where we need Truman to jump in as well. But, it's what you cite on New York Attorney General Letitia James calling for the NRA to dissolve. I'm wondering if we're seeing this backlash, perhaps. Is this the first indication of backlash against corruption so prevalent that we see in this administration? Or are basically just the slow wheels of justice, just finally taking their sweet time?
Well, to me, Kevin, that's a great question because it gets to, strategic thinking, and somebody's looking at the idea of campaign financing and trying to see if they can't get some of the private money out of campaign financing. And there's a lot of these big shadowy issues that are complex and long term that, we'll have to tackle at some point, to continue to dig ourselves out of the hole of corruption that we have all seemed to have fallen in. But, the other thing that I'd just sort of add to your kind of questions here is that I hope that we can also call out dirty tricks as we see them. Things like the dark money that's in politics, to fund very nefarious ends. I think that we need to be willing to speak out against dirty tricks and campaign financing abuses.
You know, one of the things that strikes me is that anytime you get, I mean, I'm thinking of the unions, like the Teamsters, how corrupt they became at one point. You know, I mean, the whole Jimmy Hoffa thing. Anytime you get these kinds of political coalitions going there, that corruption creeps in. And I think the NRA is just another example of that. And is it human nature? I mean, what is it, you know, that allows us to do that? Michael?
Michael, what do you think? Truman, that's exactly what I was going to bring up. And it reminds me, and Bruce, I always say this, but I take hope and I'm always reminded to remember the historical perspective. Because the NRA was a sterling organization for years.
Yeah.
They were concentrated on firearms safety, firearms training, enhancing hunters' abilities and things like that. But like you say, Truman, I think it is human nature. And it's something that we struggle with all the time. But humans, we crave power. And because my thought, what I've observed is the more power we think we have or the more power we actually get, helps us to feel safer. And we like that, helps us to feel more secure. But as Lord Acton said famously, that power corrupts. And so you just got to be vigilant as all get out, because eventually it will corrupt. But then, of course, that corruption is like rust in the inside of a metal scaffolding, and eventually the thing rots out and falls apart.
So we will clearly see how all of this corruption busting works out. But before we come to the end of the show, something locally happening on Vashon was of interest to me. There's two moves afoot on Vashon regarding our heritage. Our ancestral heritage is being recognized by Islander Julia Lakey and others, with the banner proclaiming we're on the ancestral home of the Swabok tribe. I'm pronouncing that right.
Boy, good luck.
And the other, Bruce, is inspired by you and Steve McDonald regarding the namesake Maury Island, which is now getting some dialogue going on Vashon. Bruce, what are you hearing, and what do you think this sort of changing of statues, if you will, on Vashon, what kind of effect do you think we're going to have locally here?
Well, I think, you know, let's have a little lesson in Lachute seed pronunciation right here. The native people of Vashon Island are pronounced schwa bop sh. So schwa bop, B-A-B, sh. So schwa bop. So everybody say schwa bop sh. Practice. Okay. Because it's, you know, it's like mispronouncing somebody's name. You know, it indicates that they're not important. And let me just read real quickly what the Heritage Museum has for the past 4 years, at the beginning of every activity, every meeting, every program we have, we read a recognition of the Schwabach people. And it goes, we acknowledge and recognize that we are on the ancestral lands of the Schwabach Coast Salish Native people, the first people of Vashon Island. This land was their home long before Euro-American voyagers and settlers came and displaced them. This is their traditional home, and their historical relationship with the land continues today. We honor the island itself and the Schwabach people, past and present. And the importance of that is that those Schwabach people are still here. You know, you go into museums, you go into history books, and they talk about what it was like before contact, and then the story disappears. The story doesn't disappear, and it's important for us to recognize.